You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times when talking on the show, like I said a little bit earlier, this is a follow-up to our last week. We want to compartmentalize things, and, you know, me, I'm interested in the surface running game fish, the pelagics. And even within that area of the fishery, there's a lot of you all that don't know really what pelagic fish are. And that's why we're pleased once again to have a PhD, Dr. Mark Fitchett with us. Fitchett. And it's like, I'll get it right one of these days. Anyway, what he is not only is a scientist, but he's in charge of the Pacific Fishery Ecosystems area at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And you can see some of his work at wpcouncil.org. Last week, I was mentioning that there are some fish that we come to automatically talk about now as pelagics that really people didn't get. And one of them is, and maybe because it looks like a reef fish sometimes, is the munchong. Let's talk a little bit about that. You like me, you like them. It's a great fish. And it's been somewhat underutilized so far.
Yeah, and, you know, we have a couple uniquely underutilized fish here that have traditionally had more international demand. Mm-hmm. You know, the Ama Ebi shrimp, the munchong, opa.
Yeah.
And we're very fortunate here that we've had in recent years, we've caught more in pounds of munchong than we have of ono or mahi. And in 1 year or one quarter, we caught the U.S. Or the Hawaii deep set longline fishery caught more munchong than all fisheries caught of mahi and ono.
It's amazing. So, see, here's the thing. Everybody thinks ahi and ono. That's our local inshore offshore fish. Because, you know, sometimes you can be quarter mile offshore and catch a mahi-mahi. They're in to eat.
Right.
You look at that as everybody knows, I guess, the mahi grows from a fingerling to 20 pounds in a year.
Yeah, they grow pretty fast.
A bit faster. What about munchong?
You know, that's a good question. We really, at this point, don't know. Munchong, from what studies that I've read, are divided in several subspecies. Some of them are highly prolific and much more productive than some of the other species. So that's something that we need to find out.
They have a pretty good look and a pretty big eye. So one would think, well, it's a bottom fish.
It's a pretty deep swimming pelagic. Yeah. There's two species. There's more of the open deep, big scale.
And those are pomfret, right?
Pomfret. So the munchong are sort of an amalgamation of all of the pomfrets. Mm-hmm. So you have the lustrous, which is the more seamount associated, which have a lot more meat on them, higher meat yield. Yeah. And so they're kind of a little bit, folks, I know a lot of the longliners are interested in them. And then you have the big scale, which are more commonly caught, which are still very, extremely tasty.
But, you know, interestingly enough, a lot of the restaurants here have been taking advantage of them because I guess it's a pretty flexible fish. It's sort of like swordfish. You can do all, it's the start of what's the sauce you're going to put on it. In other words, munchong is usually in dishes that require a chef.
Yeah. And it's pretty tasty. The price per pound I'm hearing has been pretty low recently because
until they discover it, there's so many
of them. Yeah. So that's one thing at the council that we're interested in is what's going on with munchong. Yeah. It historically has been sort of an incidental catch in the big eye longline fishery, but a lot of folks haven't really known what to do with them and how we market that fishery, but also how we manage it as well.
Yeah, okay, I'll talk about that, but let's first of all talk so the people understand the difference between a shallow set and a deep set longline boat. Longline boat, everybody knows, got that big reel of line on the back with 10 million hooks.
Correct.
Or a couple of thousand anyway. When we talk about the different sets, how are munchong generally found deeper?
They're found on a deeper long line. Mm-hmm. So either deep set, shallow set. Shallow set targeting swordfish. Mm-hmm.
Which is really on the surface almost.
Then the deep set targeting big eye tuna. They usually have the deep set fishery has more hooks per float. So mm-hmm. deeper set of hooks, deeper group based on the concatenary curve of the long line, a lot more hooks on deeper water. They do, Munchong have been caught in the deep set long line. I was just looking at some maps recently and some reports from the fishermen south of Hawaii, southeast of Hawaii. So when the deep set longline fishery started growing here in Hawaii, mm-hmm. further south into the southeast, they started catching more and more munchong.
No. At approximately what depth?
That I really don't know. I can tell you that...
but it's part of the deep set, so it's
part
deep,
of the deep set. Deeper. Deep, you know, yeah, anywhere yeah. from 100 to 300 meters, they've been yeah. caught mm-hmm. in that deep. Yeah, yeah. They've been caught by fishermen fishing the seamounts as well as onliners. So.
But from what I learned, and this is an interesting thing, the way they travel must be very much like some of the bait fish in schools. Because sometimes they say when the munchong hit, they light it up. I mean, they hit every hook in the line.
And that's what we've been talking to someone, reading some of the reports from some of the fishermen. They've definitely have hit, you know, pay dirt.
Yeah.
Especially on some of these seamounts.
Interestingly enough, and I don't know if you're really into this yet, but from what I understand, it also travels pretty well. It keeps.
Yes.
Yeah. Everybody knows that the number one keeper is swordfish.
Oh yeah.
I mean, number one, but by far, and then somewhere right in there is going to be munchong. Yeah. I don't know why, because they're not that big.
Yeah, and it's kind of surprising. I actually would have, because it's a, you know, because of the nature, they're deep water, and because
they're dense also. Yeah, the meat's dense,
and they're kind of an ugly fish.
Yeah, yeah.
So you think this thing going to last?
Yeah, yeah.
But they're just so excellent.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because of all of the thousands of people I've taken on tours with the auction over the years, that's the first thing people say about Opa. They're fascinated. They don't know whether it's beautiful or whether it's ugly. They just can't make up their mind.
It looks like an alien almost.
Yeah, it really does.
That crazy color.
And that huge eye looking at you.
Huge eye, and looks like a sun. It's like the body of a sunfish. Yeah.
What does that show? I do know that it's something that you've taken a look at now, and a lot of us love it. It's certainly dependent on how you cut it, when you fillet it, how you make it. It's a tremendously tasty meat. A lot of people don't realize it's a lot less meat than they think because of the size of the fish.
Yeah, and I was recently. It's funny you mentioned that. I was just in La Jolla last month prior to going to New Caledonia. We talked about it at the last show. Mm. And I met with a scientist at Southwest Fishery Science Center, Dr. John Hyde, and he's done some work. There's some folks there that done work, some work on OPA, because they're caught with them between California and Hawaii, mm-hmm. and there's two species. And it was funny. I was talking to him, and I said the exact same thing. I was like, you know, they catch the belly. They doesn't seem to be a high, like, you know, palatable meat yield. And he was like, well, mm-hmm. and explained to me that they... along the upper part. I did not know this.
Very thick.
Very thick meat very that thick. Almost is like beef.
Yeah,
and they were finding ways to cook it. And he was explaining and showing me photos of how they are cooking. There's three different really types of meat on the OPA.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only thought about the OPA.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was talking to a guy who caught one. You know, it's very, very rare to be catching an OPA trolling in Hawaii, but it happens. And this guy caught one. It was, you know, didn't belong up there, but it took a lure. He caught it on a lure. And he said that, you know, he went home and he tried to find out, okay, how to cut it, because he didn't really want to jam it up. Then he found out from a friend of his. He said, look, you cut this meat on the bias. It's a lot of meat. Don't think that there's not, it looks like it's all belly, but that part of the body, towards the front of the body and
right.
by the head, it's so thick.
Yeah,
it's dense.
And that's what, you know, he was telling me, is you have different consistencies and different parts of the fish, and you can do many different dishes.
Which is not the same as a lot of fish, is it?
Nah, yeah, it's very unique. Yeah. And they're also OPA or warm-blooded. You know, they're actually a unique fish. They have, physiologically, they are an enigma. There's two species of OPA. Caught within the Hawaii longline fleet. They just found that there's five species in the Pacific.
Wow.
So it makes it a little hard to
differentiate.
So we're getting into what council's interested in and doing some stock structure delineation information. That's a big issue as well. We know we got at least two of the species of OPA. How do we differentiate based on catch records?
It used to be that they were bycatch and reluctantly brought in. And I think that once they started having observers, that they, you know, there's no, you can't do that. You know, there's certain things that you, if you're going to fish, you're going to, what you catch, what you kill, you're going to keep. You know, but interestingly enough, these fish also seem to be, who knows where they run or how they run, but when they find you or you find them, you catch a bunch of them.
Yeah, and OPA and Munchong are those two species, you know, that they're not your stereotypical market fish, but they are so unique.
Explain it, how they're pelagic.
So just like your marlins and tunas, they're open ocean. So they're open ocean fish. They feed in the open ocean. They grow, spend most of their life in the pelagic environment, which is not necessarily associated with the bottom or the scientific term demersal.
Mm-hmm.
They're more in the open ocean, the upper pelagic environment. So there's the mesopelagic, which is the deep, which is the dark.
Yep.
When you get down to the open ocean, the dark part, but you have your epipelagic environment. So you have two pelagic environments, one that's well lit, one that's
not so well lit. That's why, hence the big eye.
And seamount associated fishes and things like that. Yeah.
Interesting though, and one of the things that I think is, it's when people start categorizing. They think of pelagic as marlin, maimai, aku, and I mean ahi and ono.
Yeah.
And yet there's all these subspecies of this other thing. I learned something. I mean, well, I learn something every day. We all do. I thought there was one OPA, but do you say there's five?
Apparently, there's five species of OPA. There could be up to. I was reading a report. Up to seven species, but likely five in the Pacific, two that are caught within the Hawaiian longline fleets.
Okay, and by the way, sometimes when you take a look at tuna, you would be amazed at how many tunas there are, right?
Yeah, the dog tooth tuna, you have frigate tuna, you have all sorts of tunas. Yeah, that,
Okay, now, one of the things that I indicated the last time we got together, and this is Dr. Mark's second time around with us. He is, once again, as a reminder, Fitchett is, he's the pelagic fishery ecosystems guy for the council. One of the things that, you know, I told you before we started chatting last week that I'd seen a recent article about, I'd seen all these shark fins all over the place. And I guess that once, and then we had the incident here at the airport where a bunch of fisher guys were trying to smuggle these shark fins out of here. They didn't realize they were smuggling. They just thought they were taking them. But isn't it sort of interesting that somehow they can upset the eco balance of fishing, and that's happening in some areas.
Yeah.
What can you tell us?
Well, before I get into that, it'd be just worth noting that the bus that was here, and I don't know if the news made it very clear.
They didn't follow it up very
they
well.
They didn't follow up. I don't know if it was followed up properly, but the fishermen that were busted here have nothing to do with the U.S. These weren't working on U.S. boots.
Right,
they were
right.
just passing through, working on a foreign vessel. So they were here. Just happened to be. This was the port of entry. So that, to make that clear. But
we made that clear only because we wanted to make sure that people didn't think that it was any part of the longline fleet or any part of our local weekend warriors. Even some of them are longliners and shoreliners.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's. Our fishery in Hawaii is completely compliant, but you're
nobody inspects people more than we get inspected.
Yeah, that's right. We're very compliant here, especially here in Hawaii. So your question is the depredation issue with sharks. So depredation is a term that is used when essentially fishermen, whether they're bottom fishing or trolling, they're having events in which their fishing is disrupted either by bait or by bycatch of sharks. And the Marianas Archipelago down in CNMI and Guam, they're finding that 40% of their trips are having interactions with sharks, or they're disrupting the fishing. You know, you see these photos of these fishermen bringing onaga heads. Like you said earlier in the last program, you know, it looks like they got a knife and cut them right by the gills.
Well, particularly a porpoise. I think even porpoises are more selective than sharks, because if you go out to the grounds in Kona, where the fishermen go to catch marlin with a live aku bait, 5-pound or 10-pound haku. When that porpoise comes in, it sucks the entire fish from right behind the gill plate back. Never gets hooked.
Huh.
You know, that's pretty amazing. You know,
interesting.
But interestingly enough, is you think, okay, this is a nuisance. But in actual fact, I guess we're just not able to share the ocean with these things. They know more than we do, and they know when to eat the fish that we're catching. So sometimes trips must be fruitless.
Yeah, and it can be an issue with the fishermen, and it's a lose lose situation also for the sharks, because you know it could induce and elicit some punitive actions against sharks when you know, like, a lot of animosity towards sharks, but also it's bad for the fishermen, it's bad for the fishery. So there's definitely a need, and so the council, we're interested in right now working with some of our scientific partners on and also over at NOAA on in Sinai and Guam on addressing this problem. One of the issues is the identification of these species. We do not know clearly what even species, which sounds kind of crazy. We don't know, but they're not like they're catching the sharks.
It's not that they're not trying to catch them.
Yeah, and there's
and they're pretty smart too. They don't want to get caught.
It could be an array of species. You know, they're hearing about these tigers that are going in and wreaking havoc on some of these bottom and troll fishers. So even the troll fishers are getting a lot of shark.
Well, I can tell you, and I had a photograph in my Pacific Boats and Yachts column a couple months ago of this guy that was trying to retrieve his lure from a great white shark. And my caption was, do you really want that lure?
No, I don't think you would
because,
keep
you know,
it.
But the point is that I guess that we've heard such boogeyman stories about sharks, and I guess everybody has to understand, you know, you're a scientist, so you got to know more than a lot of us do, that all of these things play a part in the chain. And if you eliminate any part of the chain, the whole chain gets damaged.
Right. Yeah. And you know, sharks are one of those species that you've got that have both ends of the spectrum. You got the charismatic, we call them charismatic megafauna, right? They're you know, everybody's interested in sharks. Every you know, boy and girl who's interested in marine biology, sharks. That's you know, was dolphins back in the day. Now it's sharks, and it's for good reason. They're charismatic. They're biologically fascinating animals. And on the other hand, you've got a lot of negative. You've got a lot of animus towards sharks.
Yeah.
So you know, there's a fine balance here. You know, they're extremely important animals to the ecosystem, and just like any of our living resources, that we need to get better information and we need to manage those species
properly.
Well,
you know, we could go and argue till the cows come home about what role each thing plays.
Exactly.
Let's take a look at, say, big marlin, big Pacific blue marlin. When you start taking these big fish out of the water, you may be doing the ecosystem a favor because they're eating more than they're yielding. The ones that we catch all the time are the 200-300 pounders. Those are the ones we shouldn't catch, because they're the ones that are breeding and making more babies. But the big ones, they kind of eat their weight. And pretty soon after a while, you say, if that big marlin gets caught, wouldn't that be good for the fishery, because the rest of the small marlin get to eat?
Well, you also, but you do, and the flip side of that is when you lose those large, genetically robust fish and you remove them from the population, you reduce spawning potential. It's like with you know, anything from pelagics to reef fish, you have these very large, fecund females. We used to call them boths, right? Yeah. The principle rings true with even your pelagics, with your marlins. You know, these are fish that are very prolific spawners, and you may have fish that are genetically imprinted to grow very strong and robust, and we don't necessarily want to deplete those out. It's the same. When you manage a fishery, so one of the issues, and the same with going on to that, you know, size, you know, which fish do we want to target? You know, whether they're small or large, you kind of want, there's a fine balance on what size classes and what age classes that you want to be targeting in a fishery. And like, for example, with big eye tuna, you know, the fish is doing all right, but your juvenile fishing mortality and some
very
of the purse seine is very, very high.
That's scary.
Because of the ring net and purse seine fisheries far west. And so, you know, what happens is when they do that assessment, that can have some negative impact on the outcome of the stock.
Interesting you say that, because a couple of weeks ago when we were talking to our friend Asuka Ishigawa, we were talking about turtles And, you know, the all of a sudden the rebound in certain species, in certain ones, and then the total loss in other ones. And it's kind of scary. Even I want to backtrack a little bit more too. We're talking about the sharks and the maybe that they're a problem to the fishery, a problem in some areas that they're taking the fish. But the other one is there's also like say for instance our ability to identify and help fix and cure and return to the water monk seals. And then in the main islands they come under attack by people that think they're taking fish, and they just I guess. People just don't understand that they're a part of the ecosystem. They're necessary.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of our protected resources have their role, like sharks do. Mm. You know, it goes down to a very fundamental principle in ecology: is these species have a niche. They have a role. Yeah. Sharks have a role. Seals have a role. Your marine mammals have a role, and so do turtles. So yeah. There's always a balance that needs to be taken into consideration. You don't want to have an overbalance, like the issue with sharks. The scales are tipped in one direction too far, and that where things may be negative and have negative ramifications for both the fishermen and also other fisheries.
Yeah, that's why, gang, we want to make sure that whenever you're thinking about these things, go to wpcouncil.org. Use the search word and find out about a bunch of the stuff, including this show. This is a podcast of this will be up. I should say a link to this will be up in a little one down the road. But I think that one of the things that we to make sure that we finish with the sharks is that when we talked about those guys that were here just passing through, I see the pictures still, and I'm wondering how in the heck can these species even be surviving when you see literally thousands and thousands and thousands of shark fins drying on the roof, waiting to be used, you know, in soups?
Yeah, and it's kind of ridiculous in some regards in some parts of the world. I know I remember reading in South America there was a boat that was seized, a Chinese vessel that was seized that was fishing within the Galapagos of all places, and that. It was just chock full of sharks that were not allowed to be fishing there to begin with. And they were also, you know, a lot of the sharks were finned. And so there's cultural norms and practices that you kind of have to be very, you know, careful. Yeah. But at the same time, it's important that you do not waste your resource, but also, most importantly, you need to be compliant by the rules.
Yeah.
We have laws and regulations.
It's like if you take an elephant tusk to get the tusk and you lose the elephant. You know,
yeah.
I mean, but the interesting thing about what you said about that is that when you take a look at that the small part of the fish is kept for a very high value thing. And there used to be, if you're gonna bring in the fin, you're gonna bring in the shark.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, nobody brings in fins anymore because nobody wants to bring in the shark.
Right, and many of the rules now in many places is you got to bring in the shark because also there's the meat yield issue. Yeah. You need to come by. So if you're going to be providing, a resource to the public, you can't if you just provide a resource that is just the fins. Yeah. You're depriving an opportunity of utilizing that entire meat animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by the way, you said something earlier, and I've seen this at the auction a million times. And the minute you say the word shark, it conjures up this image. The highest rated week every year on the Discovery Channel is Shark Week.
Right.
And they just run these things. Poor old Rory Schneider, that movie Jaws must have been seen 10 quadrillion times. It costs like $8 to make.
It was
a cheap movie.
I don't think he's poor.
No, I don't either. But what I'm getting at is that, you know, the best line in that is you're going to need a bigger boat when they are trying to catch that monster. But it is true. I mean, you know, aren't there still places off the East Coast where they have serious issues in the summertime with sharks?
Well, you in North Carolina, where I'm from, you don't have the water clarity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sharks...
They're eating on the braille system.
That's a good way to put it, on the braille system. Yeah. But they, you know, so sharks have different... In fact, we had a Carl Meyer in the office yesterday, very brilliant person to talk to, very fascinating. Him and Melanie Hutchinson are two shark experts here. We were just had them in the office. And it was funny, you know, every shark... uses electromagnetic are very sensitive, have a very sensitive electromagnetic system, but their primary sensory for movement or behavior or feeding can be visual, can be olfaction, can be movement in the water. So a lot of species, shark species, wherever you are, may be less of a sight predator and more sensitive to movement, I guess, in nervous water. Mm-hmm. And so in areas where you have a lot of turbidity, a lot of sand being kicked up, and where these sharks are incidentally, it's not like they're intentionally going off and hunting humans or hunting people, or there's unfortunate encounters, and you've seen quite a bit of those in Florida and Panhandle Florida, some fatal, back where I'm from in North Carolina, where you have a lot of bull sharks. Mm-hmm. So you've had these interactions, and it's
now,
been
by the way, let people know the difference between, say, a white tip or a reef shark and a bull shark.
Well, a lot of that's just the way they look. You know, they're built, the body shape, the difference is much different. But like I said, a lot of their sensories and how they hunt and what they use as a primary, cue, I guess, to want to, you know, hunt something or take a taste.
You know, the interesting thing to me about that is that they're so predictable. And I don't know what the vibration is, but I can't tell you how many people, especially in a tournament, when a shark will come up and mutilate their fist, the fist doesn't count. You know, they're gross. But it's amazing that the shark even knows when to do the hit. Because it seems like it's when you get it up the leader that the shark hits it really near your boat, not necessarily far back.
It's probably where the fish is more vulnerable. And the shark probably is, you know, through time and knows that, you know, where it's at the surface, they could probably see the fish a little bit better based on the silhouette that the fish has. And then it's easier pickings. You know, these are highly evolved, extremely, you know, fascinating physiological
eating machines.
Marvels eating machines,
Yeah. But there's another question. Somebody asked me, I ran into a POP the other day and said, you know, next time you get some of your experts on, try to find out why all of a sudden the big predator, the apex predator, in the Papahanaumoku Akea, is actually now the ulua. There's huge, huge, big ulua.
Oh yeah,
that are huge things that are actually more predators than the sharks.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. Like I was going on a dive in New Caledonia, and on the reef, and all of a sudden the reef fish
they disappear.
They're
right?
You know, I saw a darkness behind me, and it was two aluas that were the size of a barn door.
Yeah.
I know. And so it scared me a little bit. I'm in the water. I'm like, because they move quite fast and they don't lurk. But even here, you know, down in, you see these folks who fish down in, you know, Waimanalo. I was just watching some of these fishermen fish, and they're getting some nice size alua. Mm-hmm. I was on pull in. There's a lot of alua here too on Oahu.
Yeah, and incidentally, there are even times that they school. I mean, there are times that, you know, these alua, you can find them in big, large numbers. But what was interesting to me is that it hasn't been the prolific growth of the shark population in the monument. It's the alua, and that means that there's plenty of, they eat everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they'll go in and eat lobsters, but they are just like everything else. And without harvesting them, isn't it sort of self-limiting? You know, the area polices itself, it won't get overpopulated.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, and that brings up a good point. One of the things that, at least at the council, that we're interested in doing is looking at what is the impact of the monument closure on some of these fisheries, even for the pelagics. You know, you have an area within the areas under the purview of the council, at one point we had 83% of our EEZ or economic exclusion zone closed. You know, half of it is generally closed, and so that is an issue. So one of the things is, like, how are these closures impacting some of these stocks? And that's something the community needs to do, or at least the scientific community and our governmental partners need to do some due diligence and look at least in my opinion, look at what are the impacts of these closures on the lobster fishery that was closed many, many years ago, on our pelagic fisheries.
Yeah, we're also looking at, let's take a look right around the main islands here at all the berthers for the bottom fish, for the deep seven, that have got a lot of the local bottom fish saying, hey, wait a minute, there's plenty of fish. Why are you you're closing this off? It doesn't make any sense. We should be catching these things. Because now what's happening is people are going elsewhere to bring in that fish from outside. It's not as good, and it's more expensive.
Yeah, I know with the BRRFA issue, that's something that's a hot topic, and we have some staff at the council on that, as well as working with some of our state partners.
Yeah, and you know, that nothing is etched in concrete. It's amazing that a lot of us were really panicky about the monuments and, and all of a sudden, anything that makes sense, if you can scientifically explain why something should be increased or decreased, all you have to do is get people to agree on it, and then we're happy, right?
Yeah, and yeah. Sometimes, but the, you know, it's like the if you get a group of people to agree on something, and that, you know, and I, you know, I hate saying this, but sometimes best available science is not a democratic process.
Yeah,
if you get a lot of people to agree on something, sometimes you're agreeing on the wrong thing. And I think with the monument issue is something that we need to get more and more heads together now that we've had it closed for some time, looking at, so what have been the impacts?
That's a great point. And, and you know, even when we see the great rubbish pickups and all of the things that have been happening to that part of the world where there are no people, and yet they get the rubbish and they get the, you know, the debris and all of that. But I think more importantly than that is maybe having come to grips with technology has changed in osmosis over the time, really beneficially to those of you that in science that need better ways to do your stock assessments, to do your observations, to do your, you know, your sightings, if will.
Yeah. And not just you know, technology withstanding, this is that area, the closed area, is a great opportunity to actually get some answers, some really important scientific information, like what is the natural mortality of a lot of these fish. You have a laboratory just within reach, and it's a huge area.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really interesting you say that, because every now and again, somebody catches a fish that's been tagged a long time ago in a far, far away place.
Yeah.
And even people that step up and say, well, I'm not going to tell anybody, that's really, it's really doing a disservice, isn't it? Isn't it interesting what some of the reports come in and you see, I can't believe it, an opaka-paka, 300 miles from where it was tagged.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And some of these fish do move, and it's important to get that information. I know, so some of my colleagues and friends over at NOAA have been doing a really, really good job on with the bottom fish issue and doing the tagging project, and that kind of effort, you know, it, you know, on some of the pelagics is needed and has been going on. The historically, some of our friends at the Pacific Islands Fisheries Group, Dave Atano, the PRFP, Mike Musil, who was a scientist here long before I came to Hawaii. Great people have done a lot of really, really good work, and that work needs to be continued. And we need to get a tagging project for our pelagics. It's extremely important just to look at growth and also the movement.
That's a great thought. And also, tip of the hat to Ed Watamura and certainly Roy Morioka, some of the other guys that are lending their expertise to go catch bottom fish for science, not to eat or sell. I mean, to me, these guys will take their boat and come out, because their ability to catch fish are so far in front of some of the others that are fishing, because they're just that good at it. But they're also realizing that, okay, if I want to protest, I want my voice heard, I want to back it up, here's some science.
Right. And that's the thing. Our council members have been, I got to meet them firsthand at our meeting in Saipan when we, you know, in the middle
a while ago, right?
In the middle of the typhoon last month. And
let's back up a minute. when Mark and I first got together and started talking last week and now this week, that must have been an experience for a guy from a different part of the globe to be in involved in that. What happened?
Well, you know, we got hit by a typhoon. I'm no stranger to hurricanes. Growing up in North Carolina. Got hit by a bunch of gnarly ones. Then down in Miami, we've been hit. You know, that's why their mascot. Both places I come from, the Carolina Hurricanes and then the Miami Hurricanes, there's a lot of, we're used to the storms, but being down in Saipan was a very sobering experience to see the amount of destruction. And we were together with our council family, and it was a good bonding opportunity, I would say, with our council family. And but our thoughts and support, you know, go out to the folks there in Saipan and Arota and Antinian, everybody who's affected.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about you saw where you came from, it's been happening for decades and centuries, and the building is built to accommodate that stress. In other words, the building in that part of the world is fabulous. Even the Simpson Strong Tie Company and all of these other guys that make stuff that we use in Hawaii got developed in the Carolinas and in Florida and Louisiana, where you lose roofs and buildings. But when you see the islands like that, when something like that, one of those typhoons goes through, it's like barren. It's like bare earth.
Yeah, there's a lot of corrugated metal.
Yeah, everywhere.
That's what's available, the building resources. And so it was... a lot of the trees look like had metal wrapped around. It looked like tinsel because of the fierce winds. But in the Carolinas we got hit by a lot. In fact, this last fall they had Florence go through North Carolina.
Geez,
So
yeah, and we know here we just keep knocking on wood. More storms and whatnot. We're out of time, Mark. I want to thank you very much for joining
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, if you want to know more about Dr. Mark Fichette and others at the Pelagic Fisheries Ecosystem at the Council, go to wpcouncil.org. wpcouncil.org. And by the way, as we get closer and closer to the big Christmas, which is right around the corner, just another reminder to drop in on POP and do some shopping. And also the wpcouncil.org website. There's some really great materials. There's some nice calendars, some coloring books, and a lot of other stuff. Get your kids knowing about the fishery. And if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Have a great rest of your weekend. See you next time. Aloha.